You are now listening to Bookish, The Canon Continues, the podcast that's dismantling the sacred secular divide two books at a time, with your hosts, Michelle Collins and Danielle Kingstrom.
Hello, our literary listeners. You are joining Bookish Episode 8, and I am one of your hosts, Danielle Kingstrom. And just for the record, today I am wearing an eyeshadow color called Hazard. It's a smoky gray, and it makes my green eyes pop.
It also matches your weather, let's be honest.
And it's a disclaimer for what you're about to embark on today with our discussion. Hazard.
Oh, my goodness.
And I am also a writer for Patheos Progressive Christian, so you can find me there. And today I am joined by my lovely co-host. Say hello.
Hello, everybody. This is Michelle Collins. I am not wearing eyeshadow. I have warm socks on, and I'm still cold, and it's like 70 degrees. So that's me.
Well, shout out for warm sock lovers.
That's my life most of the year, warm socks.
Yes, and leg warmers. You should get leg warmers.
Leg warmers. We've had this conversation.
I know, but they're trendy.
They make me think of Flashdance, which, yeah, by the way, exactly. I heard somebody talking about yesterday. So,
oh, yeah, that's my jam right there. I love that movie. Yeah.
Do you know, and I think, it was Brene Brown I was listening to, and she was mentioning the fact that in that movie, that final dance scene where she's auditioning or whatever, mm-hmm. it took 6 different dancers to film that scene.
Holy buckets.
Yeah. Each different genre of dance that they were doing was a different dance. One of them was even a man. At least one of them was a man.
I think I remember hearing that one was a man. Because there's one part where there's the spin. Yeah. Because you're like, that's a wig.
Yeah. There's no way that's her. No. Yeah. It was 6 different dancers. I thought that was amazing. Anyway, that's a nice little rabbit trail off of what we're supposed to be doing. So.
Very interesting.
Oh, my goodness. And there's a post on here from our production that says, I need to get leg warmers. I don't think so.
Oh, I love them. I have them in every color.
Do you also have toe socks? You have toe socks too, don't you?
No, I don't do toe socks.
That's annoying as hell. I don't know why anybody wears.
My toes need to be together in a community, okay? We don't separate.
Well, see, I liken it to the idea of gloves versus mittens. In gloves, my hands are always cold, but in mittens, they're warm because everything stays together.
Yeah. That's true. Yep. And I don't like gloves either, but sometimes I have to wear them.
Yeah, sometimes. Well, and you live in the frozen tundra, so.
Yes, I do. With Elsa. Yes.
Ralph wears toe socks, apparently.
Oh, I wonder if he wears like the toe shoes too. I wanted to get a pair of those toe shoes.
I thought
one
I might
time.
Try those, but I do think they would drive me up the wall. I'm concerned he's typing again, so I'm concerned that we're going to hear
this. Justin, oh, he used to. Oh, but the wife forbade it.
The wife said no go. Okay, we're having a whole little fun thing here on the side here with the production crew here. All right, we should probably talk about books.
We should. I hear that you just read a recently released book by somebody that we've actually mentioned on the show before.
No, he hasn't got very many mentions. I don't know if anybody's going to know who we're talking about. Oh, no. Latest release from Quire was our good friend Jamal Givenchy, and he wrote the book Living for a Living. So that is the book I'm going to be discussing today. And so we should just get to it, you think?
Yes.
All right, let's just
let's jump right in.
Let's just do it. First of all, just so everybody knows, I know we mentioned Jamal a lot. There's probably a reason. Of course, we both know him and have had quite a few interactions with him. And in the interest of full disclosure, Jamal is actually my life coach.
And was my life coach.
I know. And I have you to thank for that because I didn't know that's what Jamal did until you mentioned it one time. And by then I had started therapy and that wasn't working for me. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to give this a shot. And so I spent some time talking to Jamal and I just really felt like it was a good fit. And it has been. I've been working with him, I think, it's been about 9 months now, I think.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I should get credit because I also know that one of our listeners, who's also my pen pal letter writer friend, she is working with Jamal now too. So I'm like, do I get any royalty or anything? Like, how does this work?
You need a finder's fee or something.
Yeah, right?
Anyway, I love Jamal very much. I consider him a very dear friend. He is actually on my short list of people that I go to, even outside of the coaching. that I go to when I have something I need to say and I don't need to say it publicly. And he, you know, Jamal, he's always smiling, mm-hmm. always yeah. calm. Which truly pisses me off a lot of the time, to be very honest. When I first started working with him in the life coaching arena, it annoyed the shit out of me that he got to see me cry and be angry. And he just took it so calmly. And it just made me so mad. I was like, that's not fair. Nobody should get to be that calm all the time.
I wonder how many people Jamal has seen cry, because I've cried in front of him too. And I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of
it has to be. Anyway, it's a deep, it's a very deep process if you allow it to be. And I have found it to be so quintessentially important in my life. As a matter of fact, I was speaking with him yesterday. I speak with him on Tuesdays. And I was sharing, as I had just shared with you a little bit ago, of course, I'm writing a book and I've been stuck for quite a while. And just in the last week to week and a half, I have managed to write over 10,000 words, which is phenomenal because I don't think I've written 10,000 words in the last 6 or 7 months. So I was incredibly ecstatic over that. And I didn't tell him I was doing it throughout the week. So yesterday when I was chatting with him, I said, hey, by the way, I just want you to know this has happened. And the biggest reaction I've ever seen from Jamal, his mouth dropped open. He goes, oh my God, that is amazing. I said, I know. I'm so excited. He goes, so what do you think flipped the switch? What do you think was it? And in all honesty, I can absolutely say, and I told him this as well, it's been this process. And I think this plays into kind of what his book is about. So I do have a segue here, trust me. I'm not just chattering along, but anyway.
That's good chatter.
Yeah, well, he, being able to work through some of the things that were troubling me about me has opened that back up. And you know, knowledge can only get you so far, like book knowledge or whatever. And I love books. I love learning, but it only takes you so far as you're willing to apply it to yourself.
Yeah.
And if you're unwilling to apply it to yourself, you come to a place where you're stuck. And that's kind of where I was. And plus I was still very mired down in a lot of emotion about a lot of negativity and things like that. And so, as I mentioned, I had gone to therapy. I was like, I've got to start working this out. I think this is the answer to finishing this book. And so I had started seeing a therapist. She was a lovely woman. I really liked her. She was incredibly excited about what I was writing about. And so she spent more time talking to me about how excited she was about the book than how I was actually going to write the book. And so I was like frustrated. I'm like, there's not enough structure here. And Jamal brought that structure. And so He opened up a lot of stuff in my life, as I mentioned before, things that made me angry, things that made me very sad, but things that forced me to look at myself and to take some responsibility for some of the circumstances in my life and to say, what is it that I'm learning from this? What is it that this was brought to me for? And once I can reconcile that, now I feel much more freed up to share that experience. And so now the words are coming again, which is fantastic. When I wake up in the morning and the subject I'm writing on that day is already in my head, I know it's going to be a good morning. And I say that like that's been happening for months and it's been a week and a half. So, but anyway, so Jamal's book came out called Living for a Living. And by the way, I want to give shout out to Rafael Palendo for the cover. It's a beautiful book. It's just,
I think he won. He won something on Instagram I saw. There was
that was Meg's page, right?
Yeah. He won.
Well, it's a beautiful cover. He should have. It's absolutely beautiful. And it is so apropos to the subject matter. It just gives you that peaceful, easy feeling. Now I feel like I'm listening to the Eagles, but that's what it gives me, a peaceful, easy feeling.
I'm fond of anyone who uses the color turquoise.
I agree. I think it's underused, and especially in conjunction with purple. I really feel like those are very encouraging colors to me. So anyway.
And not typically masculine.
Yeah, well, true.
Not the purple.
That's true.
I used to have arguments about the purple color, but I like seeing it more. It's a great royal.
I was going to say it's a royal color. Yes. So it is. I love it personally. It's one of my favorites. But anyway, so in reading the book, Jamal to me is not a traditional writer, not like a lot of the books that I read. Of course, I read, you know, very scholastically and things like that often for school. So Jamal is not, you know, here's point one, let me give you all my supporting documentation for it. Here's point two. He's not that kind of writer. He's more anecdotal, which I have a total appreciation for because I'm pretty anecdotal. And so I kind of love the pattern of that. So I'm actually going to start with something that he mentioned much later in the book. And that is something that he brings into his life coaching as well, as one of the upfront, almost near the beginning, pretty much near the beginning of the process. He will actually touch on this, on the six fundamental human needs. Mm. And those are certainty, uncertainty, significance, love and connection, growth, and contribution. And I had never considered those before. I mean, of course, certainty has always been a very big subject for me. I enjoy certainty. I like to know what's happening. I like to know why it's happening. I'm a very structured person. So certainty makes a lot of sense to me. And I recognize very easily that if I'm feeling out of control, it's usually because I'm feeling like I'm not certain about something. Mm. So I think those are so very important. And he really goes into great detail in those when you're working with him on a one-on-one situation. I do like, he pointed out something in the book, though, that I thought was amazing. And I hadn't considered it before, but I do think it makes sense. He said that studies have shown that whatever seemingly meets at least three of these six essential needs actually becomes an addiction. And so, you know, at first glance, I'm looking at these and I'm like, well, these are supposed to be positives. These are supposed to be, you know, the things that make life flow well. So how could it possibly lead to something as negative as what we perceive an addiction to be? But I think the point is that each one of these things can actually be used either for the good or for the bad, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. as such, yes, if you become so centered on, as he mentions, at least three of these in a negative format, you end up with some form of an addiction. And I think it's too easy to consider addiction to be substance related. When there are actually process addictions as well. Some people are addicted to shopping. Some people are addicted to reading. I'll cop to that one. I'm addicted to reading. I also
that's excluded from addiction.
Yeah, I don't think that should count either. But honestly, anything that you're using to escape reality in life typically is considered mm-hmm. addiction. And Brene Brown actually talks about that a lot as well. And I'm on a Brene Brown kick right now too, because I've been listening to her a lot lately. So, and I found a lot of correlations.
Yeah, I jog into her.
I found a lot of correlations between some of the stuff that she said and a lot of the stuff that Jamal wrote as well. So I was kind of bouncing back and forth between the two. He does bring up something else that I thought was incredibly interesting. And we've kind of mentioned this before in one of the other books. I think it was a book that you read, where he talks about the shadow self. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that it sounds like such a dark term. And I guess it kind of is to some degree. But he talks about the shadow self. I'm going to read this. He says, "This shadow self would be profoundly limited with clearly defined borders that would perpetuate a sense of separation and isolation from the world around him. Competition with all those close to the borders of this new, smaller self would ensue. This shadow self would be profoundly lacking, taking shape and definition around the desire and pursuit of that which would seem to complete the void within. This shadow self would be profoundly unwelcome and homeless. This self would be defined by a continual quest to find a home of its own and justify its own existence. This shadow self would desperately seek to belong at all costs." I think that really speaks to something very elemental in all of us and goes back to one of those basic fundamental needs that, well, actually several of them, significance and love and connection come to mind immediately. Yeah. We all have this need to be significant. And of course, we all define that differently. It's very subjective to our talents and to our interests. But there is that need. And so I'm going to cop to something. Okay. I'm going to cop to something. I'm embarrassed about it, but I'm going to cop to it anyway.
This sounds a little juicy. Said,
no, it's not juicy, really. Okay. It's my inner insecurities, which we all have, by the way. And I have to keep telling myself that so I don't feel so bad for having them. But my shadow self can be kind of a jealous bitch sometimes.
Well, damn.
Okay, I told you I was going to share. I was vulnerable. Okay. No, I have a tendency, and again, I think this comes from a place of lack mentality, that if I see somebody else doing something that I really want to do, I kind of inside, I cringe and think, well, there goes that. I can't do it now. And that person, and it almost becomes like this idea that there's a set amount like, you know, I envision a pie for some reason. I don't know why. Probably because I don't get to eat a lot of sweets and that sounds good to me right now, but whatever. Anyway, envisioning this pie. If you eat a piece of the pie, that's less for me to eat.
You know?
And so there's this feeling of jealousy that arises out of that. Mm-hmm. And that's something I'm really trying to work on because I don't feel like that's productive, but it's a reality of that shadow self that I carry around.
Yeah.
And I can choose to ignore that, or I can choose to confront it and deal with the foundation of it, which, as I mentioned, I believe is a scarcity mentality and a lack mentality. But I just loved that he brought that in because I really feel like so many of us operate from that shadow self, even if it's subconsciously.
Yeah.
And we don't confront ourselves on that. We excuse ourselves for it, you know, or we give it some poetic term like, well, I'm just existing in the dark night of my soul, you know. No, you're being a jealous bitch. Stop it.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that's just me. I'm sorry if that offends anybody, but that's just me.
It's so offensive.
Yeah, well, so you can offended. Just get over it.
No, so. I was going to say that, yeah, I think we can all relate to that. I can too. I mean, I sometimes feel like, oh, there's not enough space for me.
But, yes.
When I feel that way, I have an incredible friend who always kind of talks me up. And this one thing he said to me, like, and I think he was paraphrasing someone else, but it was, your gift will make space for you.
And oh, that's beautiful.
I know. And I have to remind myself of that when I find myself feeling like now I can't fit into this space because my gift's going to make space. Like I feel like that whenever I listen to Brené Brown. I'm like, well, I kind of want to like write about stuff like this. And I'm like, Charity did it.
And damn, I'm it, funny, like, covered that, it.
You know, because I watched her Netflix special and, you know, me and my husband watched it and we're laughing and we're crying and we're laughing again and we're crying again. And it's that kind of a show. But I'm like, I wanted to do this. Damn it. No, I can't do it. But I'm like, but no one's going to do it my way. I don't want to be the.
Exactly.
So we get caught up in that. I want to be the next Brené Brown. I want to be the next Shonda Rhimes. I want to be the next Oprah, Beyonce. But the thing is don't you just want to be you? They didn't want to be someone else. They wanted to be them. Yeah. And so that's where we have to pull back and remember, well, there's going to be space for me and nobody's done it this way and it doesn't matter. Right. And so,
well, exactly.
Yeah.
Because nobody has our perspective. Nobody has our experience.
Right.
So even if the subject matter is somewhat the same, how we approach it is going to be fundamentally different than how somebody else approaches it.
Right.
excuse me. So it's so easy to get caught in that trap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so recognizing that shadow self within ourself is, I think, fundamental to success.
Yeah.
I think that we are not able to move forward until we can look at that in the face and say, yeah, that's me.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm trying very hard to do that. It's difficult because it hurts.
Yeah.
We don't like to see that in ourselves, you know, and nor do we want to cop to it most of the time. I mean, but I've just tried to make it a habit, you know, in the last few months or so to confront myself on those kind of things. And to figure out the origin. Because the origin is important. And
fear of rejection.
Oh well, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, rejection's one of my big issues. So
I think that's humanity's biggest issue though. I mean, it's not just you.
Yeah.
Yes,
no, but we have a tendency to feel like all of this is just us, you know.
Yeah.
It becomes I mean, we're very narcissistic as it pertains to that. Everything is about us.
Yeah.
It doesn't occur to us that other people may be sharing the same thing.
Right.
But as it pertains to the book, I one of the things that struck me in the book is, and I had to, my husband and I talked about this last night. When you hear a title, Living for a Living, automatically, or at least my assumption anyway, is, oh, it sounds like it's a financial book.
Yeah.
Which, of course, finances are included in the mindset. But overall, it's more than that. But he broke down something financially that, I mean, it hits you right between the eyes. First of all, I wanted to start with some MLM speech. Now, anybody doing an MLM, good for you. Don't care. I'm not harping on it. That's cool. I've done them. Doesn't work for me. But they all have this language, and I'm positive you know what I mean, this language of motivation and building you up and mm-hmm. you have to love what you do and all these things. And so I think that a lot of times when you see a book like this, that might be your, oh, here we go with the MLM speak, mm-hmm. you know, or the motivation or whatever. And I don't believe that's at all where the perspective Jamal is coming from. But one of the things I underlined here is, why is love often cited as the most important motivation for life, yet the question of love is rarely contemplated when one considers their work? And that's a fantastic question. But then he goes on and he breaks down some stuff. He says, think about it. We spend the first 20 years of our lives preparing for work. Then we spend the bulk of our lifespan working to get to a point where we can retire for the last 10 to 15 years. And then we arrive to the golden age of retirement. Many struggle to live with meaningful purpose, which greatly contributes to the deterioration of our quality of life before death comes. What a daunting picture.
Yeah.
Like, if that's how we're living our lives, that's depressing. Like, I'm just living for this next stage. And then when I get to the next stage, I'm not even happy in the next stage. And so it sets up this idea, like, there has to be more, you know, there should be more. And so I read that, so my husband and I were talking about that. I'm like, oh my God, how guilty of this are we? You know, sitting around, well, I have to work this job because I have to prepare for retirement. Well, why? What are you going to do in retirement? Well, I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing now. I don't know. What do you love to do now? I don't know. Well, good Lord, we better figure that out. I mean, it's, I think it's an imperative question. So he contrasts this, however, and I love how he brought this in. He contrasts it with Jesus's words on the kingdom. He says, I can tell you from experience that there's a reason why Jesus contrasted the kingdom of the world, whose currency is master is money, with the kingdom of heaven that is governed by another currency entirely. In the kingdom of God, love is the currency. The currency of money and the currency of love can reveal much about the two kingdoms they represent. So one of the things that I've been working on is identifying the perspective from which I want to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I told you this, it's not a widely known thing, but you know, I'm working on becoming a certified life coach. And mm-hmm. yeah. So within the study of that, I was asked to identify 5 values that I want associated with my life. And in doing that, my values were love, mercy, joy, peace, and empathy. And so what I've started doing is identifying the activities in my life and saying, do they fit within the parameters of those values? Do they lead to those values? And if they do, then that's a good thing. If they do not, there's something I need to say no to. And I think he brings that point out multiple times in the book is, you know, at one point he gave an example in the book where he was offered a job as a history teacher and how that really kind of fit with something he was interested in, but it didn't fit where he was at in life. And so he turned it down. Well, for most people, turning down a job, especially if you're in the midst of a financial crisis, turning down a job that would be steady income and provide that level of certainty in life, that's difficult.
Very difficult.
Very. And so, but if you're living from those values, you're able to say, it has to fit my value or I'm not going to be happy. And it is going to become a negative in my life. And so I think he brings that around several times in the book. And I appreciated that because I have for too many times in my life said yes to things that I knew I didn't really want to do, but that I thought I have to. And I'm not saying there's not periods of time in life where that's just a grim reality. But the overarching echo of your life, what do you want it to sound like? Well, I want it to sound like these 5 values. And so I have to start picking the activities that are going to lead to that. So I saw a lot of correlation there between what I was learning and what he and I have been discussing. Actually, this whole book, I'll just say, this whole book to me felt like a very much a continuing conversation between Jamal and myself, because these are the things that we discuss. So to me, it just felt very comfortable. I was like, oh yeah, this is just like sitting on a Zoom meeting and having a chat. So, but in the next part that I'm going to talk about, I know many of us have discussed it as it pertains to finances and things like that, but he talks about the birds, and I'm sure immediately anybody listening can go, oh, I know what verses are used for that, you know, and, mm-hmm. and yes, he does bring those verses in. But he brought up, and I want to get to my page here. Give me one second. He brought up the ideas of the foundations of lack. And I've studied this from another perspective, and I find it amazing how it fits into so many different things. The quote in his book is, "It is a deep-seated lie that assumes something is inherently missing from our being, which needs to be compensated for. In the Genesis story of creation, this lie was the foundational basis of the serpent's deception of the first humans." So if we go back and we look at that story, they had everything. Everything was available to them. And yet the lie was, you're lacking something. Mm-hmm. And in true mimetic formula, we must go after that which somebody else has.
Yep.
So they reacted that way. And his quote there reminded me, Andre Rabe has a book called Desire Found Me, which brought this idea in startling detail to me. Mm-hmm. And this is the lie that we continue to live our lives from, that we're somehow lacking something, when the totality of everything we need is already within us. And if we truly have Christian beliefs, we know, we should know that, because it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives within me, right? And I know I don't move or breathe or have anything outside of Christ. So we should be aware that we have everything we need. And yet we live from this perspective of, it's outside of me. I have to attain it. I have to reach for it, even to the point where we're discussing God as something outside of ourselves. And so this lie of scarcity, or this lie of lack, is foundational in everything that we find ourselves struggling with.
Yeah,
that's my estimation anyway. My estimation.
Okay, but and here's where I have kind of concern, because
okay,
I think it's privileged information to even be aware of that. I mean, there's so many people that don't have the choice to consider, is this a lie of lack or is this a real scarcity? And for me, I just think, I don't know. I worry that saying something like this can seem so simplistic from a different economic position and doesn't really consider that a lot of people don't have choice. Like, you can say, well, everybody has a choice. And okay, logically, everybody has a choice. But so many people have very limited, narrow choices of either nothing or something close to nothing. And so, I mean, this mentality, I can wrap my head around, because I've gone through life coaching with Jamal for one, and I've read similar people for two. And I can't deny that I don't live a privileged life. I have the ability to, you know, read books all day and homeschool my kids and go get a tan and garden and go wherever I want and do this. And my husband works and I'm provided for. But I've also lived from a place where I didn't have a choice but to have three jobs to pay for daycare so I could also go to college and do it on my own. And also, you know, so, and back then, nobody could have convinced me that it was my mentality that was making me, you know, because that's kind of what I perceived a little bit, is it's this mentality that creates this poverty. And I'm, well, no, sometimes it's just reality that creates the poverty. And no matter how hard you push back, you're always held in that position. And you can have a victimized mentality, or you can have a, I'm going to push through it no matter how hard you push back, even if that means I suffer through it mentality too, which, you know, there's a lot of those stories out there that no matter how hard it was, I kept fighting, and it was hard damn work, but it was worth it in the end, because look at me now, I'm on Broadway, or look at me now, I won a Grammy, or what have you, you know? And so, yeah, that was my concern with that, is I just kind of thought maybe a little bit more acknowledgement of economic privilege could have helped better, I don't know, present this to not seem like it was forgetting the little people, I guess.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. I get that. I do think that, yes, there are circumstances, there are places, especially in our world, where people are at such a disadvantage economically and governmentally and societally, that of course this couldn't be their focus.
Yes.
And you're right, we are very privileged that we have the ability at some point to sit down and consider these things.
Yeah.
And I think that is another part of why we're supposed to be working. To me, I just look at it and go, okay, then I have a greater responsibility. Mm-hmm. I have a greater responsibility because I have this privilege, as it pertains to other subjects as well. But as I have this privilege, I have a greater responsibility to figure this stuff out so that I'm actually able to mirror that back out into the world for those that don't have those advantages.
And put it into action. And, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that while that's a perfectly valid, you know, argument against it, I 100% agree. I feel like that actually puts more of the onus on me to say, okay, then you got to get your shit together because the world needs the information. And this goes along with the same idea of presenting the gospel. I mean, there's so many of us, and myself for years was included in this, that we're so mired down in our own negative self-talk of being in shame and guilt and not good enough for God, that we never pick our heads up and look around and think, I need to know that I'm accepted so that I can go accept other people.
Yes.
You know, and be the good news, to be the gospel.
Yes.
And so I'm fully aware that those situations exist. And I agree with you. I feel like there are people that might hear this without having read the book and go, well, that's not my experience.
Yeah.
And that's probably very true.
Yeah.
You know? So it does become something of a place of looking at where you are in life and deciding, you know, how you want to respond to this and say, well, do I use this information selfishly or do I use it for the greater good? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's Jamal's heart. His heart is, you know, I want to reach out and touch people in a positive way and bring healing. And he uses that word with me a lot, healing, you know, because I feel like that's what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be healers.
Yeah.
You know, now I don't know that fits everybody's personality, but it is fit for mine. And so that's, you know, I'm trying to focus on that, but, And to be honest, I mean, you know, he mentions in the book the myth of hard work.
Yeah.
And you know, I have a friend, he's a Facebook friend. I've never met him face to face, but I've been friends with him for quite a while and we know each other pretty well. We go back and forth in private messages and stuff. But he makes a comment often that you cannot claim hard work for your success. You have to understand that privilege has played a part in that. And I do agree with him. However, I'm going to say that doesn't diminish the fact that I've worked my ass off for certain things.
Right.
Nobody handed me a degree. I had to go work for it. But I recognize the privilege and the fact that I was able to go get one.
Yeah.
You know, and so there is that myth of hard work. I do believe that people work hard. And so if they hear a comment like, oh, well, hard work is a myth, they're immediately going to bristle.
Yep.
And react because they do feel as though what they've tried to share with the world has been diminished somehow. And I certainly don't want to diminish anybody's hard work, but I do see the idea of privilege playing in as well.
Yeah.
He makes a point in the book, though, about hard work. He says their commitment to hard work drives them from a place of fear of becoming destitute and a fear of not measuring up to a perceived standard. So the myth of hard work is a reality for most people because we've been conditioned to believe that success comes as a result of hard work.
Yeah, you know? Perhaps. Okay, but here's where I have to push back a little bit because, okay, and so my husband read this too. We both read. I'm not going to lie. I read this book three times because I have the privilege of being able to talk to Jamal.
And right.
When do we get, you know, I don't get to talk to Carl Jung, you know? I don't get to call up like even like Nadia and be like, girl, you know, in this chapter, but with Jamal, I can. And I did in a couple attempts to try and clarify a few things because initially I read some things and I was like, what did I just read here? And so that's why I had my husband read it. And he's like, why? And I'm like, we just read it so I can talk to you about it. Will you read it? Yeah, I'll read it. Okay. And so this particular idea, the myth of the hard work, so here's where I push back.
Okay.
I'm a Beyonce fan. I don't know if you all are aware of that, but I am.
I know. I'm surprised. I've never mentioned it.
If you don't know, now you know. Okay. So while I was reading Jamal's book for the third time, I also spent my weekend watching Beyonce and Brene Brown.
Okay.
And writing notes and like writing stuff and analyzing and going back. And so, okay. Well, in Homecoming, you know, this girl, Beyonce, she kills herself. She goes like, I just had twins. Now I'm going to start. And I'm going, you are crazy. And she literally almost killed her body. And she knew exactly what she was doing. And she knew it was exhausting and draining and took the life out of her. And she had to make sacrifices to stay away from her children and her husband. And she knows it's damn hard work, but she was born for it. And she said, this is my gift. This is what I was born for. So no matter how hard it feels, no matter how much it beats up my body, I love it. And so that's where I go, look, I feel the same way about everything I do. You know, parenting is really hard work. Oh my God. And you know, we all have those, especially as mommies, have those moments where I'm like, can I just run away and no one will notice? And I'm gone. You know, it's hard damn work, but we love those kids. And we love being able to, I mean, maybe not all of us do. I shouldn't speak for all moms. Maybe some of you are like, I do not. I love helping establish and develop another human being and develop relationships. So that's it. No, the poop, the vomit, the 3 a.m. bad dreams, whatever. You know, it's like,
oh my God, I'm so glad I'm past
right,
that.
Right. And I'm about to be a grandma on top of it. Yeah, I get to do it again.
Oh my goodness.
And so for me, I don't know. It's just like, especially this blue collar label and a lot of these, you know, that's my husband. That's my father-in-law. That's my brother-in-law. Those are my neighbors, the blue collar crowd. And they know farming's hard damn work and it takes blood, sweat and tears and it's painful and it will beat up your soul, but they love every moment of it. The soil's in their blood. And so without knowing Jamal, someone who I would worry that someone who reads this particular chapter, like my husband did, who does not have a connection with Jamal like I do, he was insulted, you know? And so we had to break it down and we had to both say, now, I think what he meant was, but for me, it was like, yeah, I know what he meant. But at the same time, I know a lot of people don't have the same perspective I do to be able to dig deeper into this and see, I don't know. I understand the idea. You shouldn't think that that's the only way you will have success. You shouldn't think that it will take everything out of you. But some people want it to take everything out of them. And then I go back to this whole idea that life is suffering and it's through the suffering that you realize where you can find the joy. And so I think, well, what about that contrasted with this idea? Then how do I reconcile that? You know, and so it's just obviously my beliefs, my perspective, coming across somebody else's belief and perspective. And it's just not wrong. He's not wrong. I'm not wrong. That's just where my question lies. And and so maybe we'll have to ask him sometime.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. We should. Yeah. I will say that my impression of that was that he was not demonizing the blue collar mindset. I think he was just identifying it as one that's culturally out there.
That's known for that mentality.
Right. And here's what I think. I think to your example of people that are farmers or whatever, if that's what they love, then they are living for their living. They are doing what they love. Yeah. And so it is the right thing, regardless of how culture might label it, like blue collar, as though that's second class or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably where a lot of the pushback comes from, is that's automatically a term that's, in my impression anyway, is considered second class.
Second class and people of color and minority.
Things like that. Well, I think that's right away where some of that reaction comes from. But I take it that he was demonizing that in any way. I think he was just differentiating. And so I would say, as I just did, in response to that, if that's what you do and that's what you love and you're willing to put your blood, sweat, and tears into it, then by God, do that. I mean, that's what makes you feel alive. Then you are living for your living.
Yeah.
And that's impressive.
Yes.
Farming is not my deal. Yeah. I can't even keep a plant alive anymore. Oh. So, I mean, I used to have a lot of plants. They were beautiful. And then I had kids. And my husband used to get on me all the time, like, you haven't watered the plants. I'm like, it's the plants or the kids. Pick which one.
The plants.
Because I can't do it all. Anyway, that's my segue. I can't farm. So, but I am obviously dependent upon people who can.
Yes.
And I would hope that they love it or they shouldn't be doing it. Because it's a damn tough job.
Well,
so
I'll tell you, there are a lot of farmers out there that are just living for the money and they are just doing it. So I just want to, Monsanto kind of
group. Yeah. Well, yeah. And that's true in every kind of every profession has that.
Yes, there's always those people who are like, I don't care. It's all about the money.
Well, and we're conditioned that everything should be about the money. Yes. I mean, think about it. When kids start thinking about what they want to be when they grow up, they're not talking about, well, what do I love to do?
They want to be rich YouTubers. That's what they want to do now.
Well, yeah, now they want to be social media influencers. Yes. That's a term I just learned. I was like, what the hell is that? Somebody that posts on Instagram 6 times a day. I don't know. I'm trying to understand it. But anyway, one of the last things that I wanted to bring up here. As I said, I was listening to Brené Brown this week too. I did watch her special on Netflix. But I've also got a lot of her stuff on audio and I've been listening to it again. And one of the things that she brings out that I think fits the spirit of this book is that she talks about that those authentic live from their heart kind of people. Mm-hmm. And she said, in her research, what has come up are a couple things that are inherent to those kind of people. It's not that they don't have problems. It's not that they don't have challenges. They still get divorced. They still go through, you know, death in their family. They have all these things. But the couple things that they have in common is a life of gratitude and being thankful for everything.
Yeah.
And also that sense of play, putting play back into their life. And so, you know, Jamal mentions a gentleman in here who walked away from what he was originally going to study in college. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the gentleman. I want to say Michael, but I don't think that was it. Anyway, he walked away from it, bought a parcel of land, started working on meditation, and all of these things began to come to him. Well, he was playing, but then life began to come towards him.
Yeah.
And that's what she's talking about as well. Brené talks about the idea that this is how you live from your heart. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like as an overarching theme for what Jamal was writing about, that's what he's wanting to say is we have to live from that place of gratitude and play that becomes how we make our living.
Yeah.
It becomes how we live and how we love and how we function. And when we do that, then we have the opportunity to be much happier looking back over our life and what we've accomplished.
Yes.
And that's what I took away from it anyway.
Yes, first.
And yes, you're right. Along the way, there are those pushbacks, but the overarching theme is that of living authentically.
Yeah.
From yourself.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I really love that. So
I love it. Yeah. First you play, then you slay.
All day. That's the new word. All day. Slay. I've been All noticing day. That everywhere, and I know you use it a lot.
Slay?
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Beyonce's word. It's not my word. I'm not taking credit.
Yeah,
for that.
I know. But I know you're not taking credit. I'm just saying, I hear you say it a lot. Yes. And I've been hearing it from other people a lot too. And I was like, oh, that's the new word.
No, so. I've literally been saying that at home, play and slay, because I. and I watched a TED Talk Shonda Rhimes did about her being a Titan and talking about how she lost her hum. And then she refound her hum in playing with her kids. And I was like, that's what I do. Like I get writer's block and I'm like, okay, I'm going to go play with the kids. And I do it like 3-4 times a day where I'm just like, will you guys play with me?
Aww.
And it's usually wrestling around or horse, or we do yoga together. Or I'm like, do you guys want to lift weights with mommy? Or do you want to dance or whatever? Yeah. Let's go outside and run around. But you go play and then I come back in and I'm like, yeah, man, I'm like totally ready to sit down and write a whole freaking article right now. Let's do this. Those darn kids, man, the play. It's the play.
But well, exactly.
But I mean,
and that's, it helps inspire. It helps us recalibrate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Find that center again.
Yeah. I really dug the play part in this book too. I really, I literally reread that part. Like right after I finished watching Shonda Rhimes, and I'm like, well, I'll be damned. Everybody's talking about this thing now. Okay.
Well, I think we tend to see it more when we come on something. We're like, we tend to see it everywhere in all of our interactions and everything.
We're drawn to that force of flow and to that area that we're paying attention to.
Exactly. Yes. And I think that segues into what your book was about, because I saw in the notes stuff about tantric union and things like that. And I went, what the hell are we going to talk about here? So let's get to it, girl.
Okay, well, we'll do that. So the book that I am reviewing is called The Sophia Code by Kaya Ra. Okay, and so, okay, this woman had an incredibly awful childhood. She was, and I'm, oh my God, I was not expecting this. I'm like, what? So she was basically born and bred into sex slavery.
Oh, God.
And so for like New England and the Northern Midwest, where politicians and celebrities and elites would pick and choose from this family of bred sex slaves.
Oh, yeah. Good Lord.
So she did this until she was a teenager when she escaped. And so I'm going to skip all over that stuff because I was just like, what?
Are you in tears and devastated emotionally?
Okay. And so,
triggered.
So then we fast forward to she goes to college. She gets degrees. She starts trying to make something of her life. She's trying to heal from trauma. And she always led from as far back as she can remember. She always had some kind of a deep spiritual connection. She always felt like there were angels with her. She always felt like there were deceased spirits following her around. These deceased cursed spirits from previous victims of this family of sex trafficking that would come around to haunt and taunt and whatever.
Wow.
Fast forward, she wants to become a writer of some sort and has a vision. She's visited by God. And God is Sophia, a woman. Look, I was like, we're going into this. We're not making any judgments. We're not going to have any biases, but I'm going to be honest. It's a little hocusy pocusy. And I was like, you know, if God was going to return to like, tell me, look, I'm a woman. Why is God coming back? Why did you come back in the same way that God visited all the men? Like, couldn't you have thought of something differently? I don't know. So that was my first take. But you know what? Who am I going to tell God how to come to someone? So never mind.
How dare you?
How dare I? So basically, this book is about the knowledge that she was given during this divine inspiration. She wrote a book about it, which I think is quite fitting for what we do here on The Canon Continues. So she introduces you to something called a key code. And that's basically this knowledge that you have to unlock. Basically understanding your inner divine inheritance, which I thought really mirrored a lot of what Jamal was writing too.
Mm-hmm.
And she does, I mean, she uses even very similar phrases where I was like, Jamal, did you read this book? And he's like, no, I've never read it. And I'm like, holy cow, it's so much like yours. It's weird. So introduces us to these divine feminine Christ teachers. And so that's basically what the focus of the book is, all these different goddesses throughout history. And some of the names are familiar and some are not.
Right.
Isis, Hathor, yeah. And then we have Mother Mary, Mother of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, someone by the name of Kuan Yin, who has another terrible, traumatic sex slavery story. And then the White Buffalo Woman, which is a more indigenous goddess reference that I believe would be familiar with Native American tribes. So there were, I was like, Mary Magdalene, well, of course. So this is basically like a sisterhood lineage of goddesses is what she takes us through. And okay, so the number one thing that I really appreciate about this book is that there were just these multitudes of different prayers and affirmations found throughout all the sections, even when she's introducing these different goddesses and how invoking these goddesses into your life can help strengthen different chakras and can help just kind of heal you from within and more of a feminine embracement. So I would say, you know, women are going to get a lot out of this. Although I did find a lot of male reviews of this book that I was like, wow, it's pretty cool. But I really appreciated the prayers and the affirmations, and I actually incorporated a lot of them. Specifically, there were two mornings that I had to get up early and take care of something with a friend. And she was facing something personally trying. And I did a couple of sets of these prayers the nights before I went and helped her. And it was like, she could feel this additional energy. She's like, it feels like a good day. And I was like, yeah, it feels like a good day. So I don't know. I think prayers work. So I mean, that's what I appreciate. It just kind of helps. I love books that deliver me some form of prayer or meditation or affirmation just to kind of help recharge myself and remind myself of, you know, the divinity within and the love within and the strength and the courage and, you know, knowing who I am is who I am. And so that's kind of the the message I got out of this book too is this is a discovery of who you are and remembering who you are and how beloved you are and how significant and already seen. And I would say piggybacks off of a lot of, you know, I'm familiar with Jamal's idea of the lilac too. And I've really clung to that as well. I like that idea. And it's similar within this book, you know, we have this lie that we're not good enough or we're not smart enough or where women aren't enough, or we don't have some power to heal ourselves, which isn't true because she died like 3 times,
wow.
You know, which again, near death experiences she talked on, Jamal talked on, again, it's yeah. Like, so weird that these books lined up. Anyway, I just wanted to point that out. Divine inspiration. They must like bookish up there in heaven. They're like, yeah, that's a good one down there, ladies. But yeah, so one thing that really stuck out for me was that she really takes you through to how important it is to kind of, hi Major, she really takes you through these layers or how to strip down these layers, these false ideas, these false identities that we carry around about ourselves so that we can gradually learn how to release like harmful judgments of ourselves. Because, you know, we judge ourselves more than anybody else. Even if we think we're always judging other people, we're probably judging ourselves 9,000 more times than we are. And just these affirmations and meditations for me would be so helpful to so many people who find themselves kind of covered in that beginning deconstruction post-goo cleanup. Like you're still kind of removing all the residue of whatever you were leaving behind. And, it can either kind of try and pull you backwards to where your mindset used to be, or sometimes you just need a meditation or an affirmation or maybe an incantation for Hathor to come and be present with you. I don't know. To kind of pull you back into the now.
Piss off some Christians here, Danielle.
I know. They're still over there going, did she really just call God a female? I haven't heard anything.
Yeah, they're still hung up on that. And now yeah. You just invoked another goddess. So
one of the repetitive parts of the prayer that you kind of like end a lot of the other prayers with is this that I just wanted to read that I thought it was really cute and I really like. So I accept that I hold the golden keys to my heaven on earth. I accept that I create my reality by the power of my word. My word is good. My heart is pure. By the loving power of my pure word, I call forth and invoke the full presence of forgiveness for myself now. And I'm like, wow, you know, just that prayer alone could release so many from these shackles of shame. Just sometimes yes. I think that's where the beauty in the prayer comes. If you're really feeling what you're saying and you're really holding on to those words and letting those words kind of like wrap themselves around you, forgiving yourself is a huge part of
Oh, for sure.
Your process of healing. And it reminded me of, you know, I did all sorts of crazy stuff when I was a young single mom and I practiced Wicca for a few years. Hmm. And so a lot of this book remind me of just Wiccan practices, kind of like oneness with nature. And I think when I was practicing Wicca, I was referencing God as a female. And I would call on, well, she references Lilith. And I'm like, we were taught to call on Lilith to protect our children. But then curiously, Carl Jung talks about Lilith as being a demonized, goddess, which I didn't know. And I'm like, oh, well, whatever she did, she protected my kids, I think. See, the Christians again are going, who is this woman?
Yeah, they're all up in arms now.
I don't do that anymore, but I'm not judging people do. But one of the things that I remember doing a lot was apologizing and forgiving myself while looking in the mirror. Have you ever done that?
No, just recently. That's been part of what I've been walking through is forgiving myself for some stuff.
Yeah.
And in all honesty, I was actually coaching somebody yesterday, and that was actually something I gave to them as well. Like, here's what I see, and you need to forgive yourself for this.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that often, and I wanted to go back to something in the midst of that conversation, you were talking about the prayer and going out with the prayer and how, you know, beneficial that is.
Yeah.
I think part of the problem is that we still see God outside of ourselves, whatever yeah. God you're talking about, we see outside of ourselves.
Yes.
And the reality is, so that prayer that you prayed, it is beautiful because it's speaking to ourselves, but it is still prayer because God is internal.
Yeah.
So you're still definitely. Praying to God. So just to appease some Christian mentality, you're still praying to God because he resides within us.
Oh, well, here. So, yeah, you'll love these following then. Okay, so I want to read a couple just because it piggybacks off of what you brought up.
Okay.
So I forgive myself for the destitution created by vows of poverty that have kept me separated from the abundant, prosperous God self within me. I forgive myself for forgetting that heaven is always within me. Mm-hmm. I forgive myself for indulging in the terrifying illusion that there is a force stronger than the God self within me that could end my life. I forgive myself for belittling my direct connection to the God self within me. And so there's like four pages of this. Hmm. Realizing the God self is right there. God's right there with you. And I got that out of both books, Jamal's and Kaya's. And yeah, and that's kind of like, that's the mentality I have in my life too. Like we have these divine gifts of God. We have pieces of God. The God self resides within us, and whatever we're aiming for, that's the gift of our divinity within. And I think that's ultimately how we display what our divine inheritance looks like. And that shows us which part of the body of Christ we are, essentially, for me. That's what I think.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that, and I don't think I've said this anywhere else, so I'll just go ahead and say it publicly. What the hell? In my ponderings of God, because I have, you know, reached a point in my personal deconstruction, my transformation, as to questioning the validity of God. And somewhere within that, my mind started thinking differently about God. I stopped, as I mentioned, I stopped seeing him as an outside force. And I started pondering and saying, what if God is truly just the totality of humanity together?
Yeah.
Which is why we're supposed to forgive our enemies and pray for those that persecute us, because they're actually a part of us.
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah. And in that same line of thinking, because we know that the term Satan means the accuser, the totality of humanity is also the Satan.
Yeah.
We are all the accuser of the brethren. And most importantly, we are the accuser of ourselves, which comes back to what you're saying there. Being able to forgive ourselves is putting aside that satanic voice that would accuse.
Yeah.
And it's very important.
Yes, it is. And, you know, one of the most important aspects of a tantra, of what tantra is. Okay. And so I know a lot of people are like, tantric sex? No. That's not
that's
just
where
what
I went
it is.
First. That's the only way I know the term. So I don't know what it is other than that. So.
Well, I'll just say we might have a book coming up in the near future that talks about that. But for now, we're talking about tantric union, and that's about the tantric union with God. Okay. And so just briefly, what tantra means is to loom, warp, and weave. And what you are weaving in is this, the threads of all of your existence in this integrated spiritual being that you are. And so maybe that'll start giving people ideas of what tantra sex is. No.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
So that's what it is. So what you're basically doing is you're integrating everything into your life into one. You realize that your spirituality, your sexuality, your humor, everything about you is also about God. And everything that you do, your practices, your behaviors, your characteristics should all be reflective of that integrated self. And so that's where making sure that you understand and you acknowledge the God self within you plays a part in this kind of tantric union, because like this idea that we're separated comes from not having this tantric union, this oneness with God, with understanding and embracing the God self within us. And that's that where the lies of the lack come into play, is because we forget we're already meant to be fully integrated human beings, which includes the God self. And it's, you know, we need books like these to remind us how to get back to that idea. But nonetheless, that's what this tantric union represents, is just embracing it and then integrating it into all aspects of your life. So when, you know, when do you know that you are a disciple, or when do you know you're a true Christian, or what have you? How are all these ways that we validate what a person does? Well, because they practice what they preach, and what they preach is of love and of connection and of unity. Right. And so, yeah, and you haven't lost that. You don't have to search for it. You just have to pull it outside from within. So I love that. What I didn't like about, and okay, so I'm just picky with words. So I'll just be honest. I'm picky with words. I don't like words that make me think of money or property. And so that's all I'm going to say. I just wish you wouldn't have used money words. I don't like that. I think there is a vastness of rich and delicious language out there that could have been otherwise used. Here's my problem. And that's where my initial knee-jerk reactions came with Jamal's book. Yeah, I had some. I'm like, prosperity. It's like a prosperity gospel.
Yeah.
And I couldn't. And so for me, because I'm picky with words, I'm like, we have to stop thinking this has anything to do with he's trying to get you rich quick, or that the Sophia quote is, because she uses the same words. And I'm like, is this trying to, you know, we have that lens and that bias that we don't even realize. And it just kind of like flips downward and you're like, now I see it. Maybe it could be because I have some post-traumatic trauma from Dave Ramsey. I don't know what it is.
Well, no, there is just some language. As I pointed out earlier, there's that, to me, I call it the MLM language. It's that constant, you have to have a smile on your face and be motivating somebody. Yeah. And, you know, it just comes off as not genuine and not authentic, I think, sometimes. Yes. Or it does to me anyway. I'll just speak for me. It just, as soon as somebody starts that with me, I'm like, you're going to need to get real, real fast, or we're going to be done having a conversation.
I can talk to Jamal about it and be like, okay, so this word right here, it just makes me, you know, it triggers me, Jamal, change it. No, I wouldn't say that to him, but you know, you don't get to do that with everybody. So again, we're admitting it. How many times have we said Jamal? We should start charging him every time.
It should be a bingo game, right? A bingo game.
What I ultimately wanted a little bit more out of from this book was a way to put this into a better connected application. And so having just come off of my Brené Brown trip and and I myself write about connection, and I myself am like really invested in the idea of connection and communication. For me, the Sophia Code lacked an integration with a community for me. It was all about self-divinity and self-compassion. And I get that you have to heal yourself before you can really truly love another person. So, I mean, I appreciate that. But, and maybe that's where the second volume comes in that she has available for purchase.
Oh,
she has a second
one. Oh, okay.
But maybe. I felt it was too self-centered on just your relationship with God, with Sophia, and not so much on how do you project this outward.
Right.
So I would have appreciated that. One other thing that I thought was really cute that she pointed out that I've never really paid attention to before, and now I'm going to, is chakras. And she really talks a lot about the chakras in here and the elements, and just the sacredness and understanding the elements of the earth and the seasons and the oneness with, you know, nature. I don't know if when you're doing like your hikes and your runs and your, well, you don't run, your walks, right? And your climbs. Do you feel more connected somehow? Like you're feeling energy, like charging you when you're outside?
Honestly, well, first and foremost, I'm an introverted personality. Mm-hmm. So groups do not work for me. I get highly agitated and I get exhausted pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. I find that when I've been working too much or concentrating too hard, or I'm very stressed out, that being outside in nature, yes, does afford me that sense of energy. Yeah. I attribute it a lot to silence as well. And I went hiking this last weekend. I did, a 7.5 mile hike this last weekend. Jeez. And I was by myself. Wow. And I was listening to Brené Brown while I was hiking, and about 3/4 of the way through, I thought, what am I doing? I need to shut up everything and just be silent for a little while. Mm. And so I turned it all off. I took the earbuds out and I just listened to the wind blow as I walked. And I listened to the sound of my own breathing. and my footsteps in the dirt, and allowed myself to just become very introspective.
Yeah.
And there is a sense of peace and calming that comes along with that. And because I'm introverted, that sense of peace and calm actually is what energizes me.
Yeah.
So to me, I love that. I love the nature of it. I love being outside. A few weeks ago, you may have seen the pictures. My daughter and I went to the Super Bloom
Here
in California. It was absolutely beautiful. But the entire time, because we're both so much alike, the entire time we were complaining about there's too many people out here.
Yeah.
Too many people intruding on my peace and quiet.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love nature. I love being outside, and I do find that that's what centers me and brings me back to that feeling of being okay.
Yeah.
And it's important that we have that. And everybody gets that from different places.
But. Yeah. And so when she talks about Isis a lot, you know, Isis is connected to the nature. And I don't know if something about it just made me think about like how much I enjoy my time out in my garden when it's just me. And all I can hear is the hum of the bees and the grasshoppers. And the sounds are literally of just the wind and the insects and So I would recommend this book if you can go into it really open-minded and because I mean, I felt uncomfortable at times because it was like, well, and now Mary Mother will speak through me. And I'm like, whoa,
Jesus's
mom is talking to me right now. Like, hold on. This is Jesus's mom. And now Mary Magdalene will speak. And I'm like, for real? Like, okay, so what did you think of Cynthia Bourgeois's book? And no, I'm just kidding. But it was hard for me. I feel so bad doing this.
I get it.
But I mean, it was interesting too. I mean, just learning about all these other goddesses. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not big into like, I need to know which god was what the right god for me to worship and what does it look like? Because, God's already in me. So here's what God looks like. Look at me, sweetheart. No.
Right.
No, but it's true, and you know it. And look at Michelle, and look at everybody. That's what God looks like.
Look at me. I'm a bad representative.
Whatever. Bad reputation. You should check out her Facebook page. She's representing bodybuilding, okay?
Oh, okay. Yeah, but that gets me in trouble, too. I get a lot of weird comments about stuff like that.
Haters gonna hate.
Yeah, they do, too.
Yeah, big deal.
They're just past caring about
it. And why are they hating you, Michelle? They have no business hating you if they're not in the arena with you. Okay.
Oh, see, I love that quote, by the way.
Oh, my gosh,
like
I know.
One of my favorites.
I know. So I got a lot of criticism from a lot of people after I heard that. And I just sat there and I was smiling like, I know you're not in the arena, so I'm not even reacting.
I don't even need to talk to you.
Yeah.
I mentally put my hand up and said, whatever.
Yeah, right? Like, I'll listen to the people who are right here in this arena with me, okay?
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's one of the best comments I've ever heard, and very much hits you between the eyes, and you're like, holy crap, yeah.
Okay, so when I meet Brené Brown, I'll tell her that you like it.
Absolutely, you tell her.
If you can't see it, you can't be it. I can see it. I can see it.
There
I'm gonna
you
be
go.
Hang- no. There she's
go.
A funny woman. Oh my
I know,
gosh.
I like her
I
a
love
lot.
Her.
Yeah,
we should do a Brené Brown book since we talked about her more than the other two.
I actually have the newest one. I think it's called Dare to Lead.
Yeah.
And honestly, I had a hard time with it.
Really?
I really did. I didn't get very far in it. I need to go back and give it a second chance because all of her other stuff is so much about vulnerability and shame and courage and all of these things. And this felt more like a business book to me. And I was like,
Well, she
which
did
I understand.
Just,
I know all those things have to be used in business, but I was just like, oh, it's not the mentality I was looking for. But I'm going to go back to it because I may have
Esther Perel did that. Yeah, Esther Perel did that too with one of her sex books. She wrote it for like CEOs and entrepreneurs. And I'm like, wait a minute. This is weird
for me. It's
a different
feel. Yeah, it's a different feel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I went back to the stuff I had from her on Audible and just started listening to it again because that's the stuff that really speaks to me.
Yeah.
Because it's stuff I'm working on, so that's probably why. But
she probably wrote that book for like Google or something, you know, like
maybe
those kind of people. Like,
she's great, no matter what.
Oh, she is, yeah. But you know, when they ask you to come out and write a book,
you have to tailor it. Basically,
they're like, "We love your message. Now do it for our corporate." Okay, I'll do it. You know, like why wouldn't you?
Exactly.
Yeah. Speaking of books, what are you reading next week, Michelle?
I've not 100%. Decided, but I'm 99% sure that this is going to be the book. It's called All About Love by Bell Hooks. And because we haven't mentioned her name enough, I was introduced to this book by Brené Brown. It was a vague reference in one of the things I was listening to. And I thought, I've not heard of this woman. And so then, as I think I mentioned to you earlier, I went and pulled up her Amazon list of books and was like, oh my God, there's like 15 books here I want to read.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and yeah, it's called All About Love.
I just ordered that book too, so I'm going to read it with you.
See, look at this. We are in sync.
Oh, we're totally in sync. And so then
what are you reading next?
I'm reading The Body Is Not an Apology by Sonia Renee Taylor.
What is that about?
It's about the power of radical self-love.
Oh, okay, cool.
In any size.
Well, look at that. We're both going to be talking about love. We are so in sync.
I know. We were meant to do this podcast. I'm telling you. All right. And so what I'm going to tell you, lovely listeners, is that if there's a book that's inspired you and you'd like to consider us, you'd like us to consider discussing it on one of our next podcasts, please email your recommendation to us at bookish@quoir.com or check us out on Facebook. We have a bookish group where you can join in the conversation and share recommendations. And then if we choose a book that you have suggested, we will give you a big old shout out on our next podcast. And my grandma, I'd just like to say, recommended a book for me titled Athena. And so I'm going to look into it, Grandma. Thank you for that.
Good for her. Good.
And so then until next time, we'll talk to you later.
Yep. Have a good day, everybody.